The Outpost Radio on Demand. Here's Art Young from the Outpost Magazine.
One of my favorite quotes about conservation came from a man who's known for his work with birds. And it's a true conservation is a man who knows that the world is not given by his fathers, but borrowed from his children. James Audubon said that. And he may have been thinking about, or at least anticipating, what's going on in the state of Louisiana now with the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Our guest today on the Outpost is R. Bob Love, who is the Coastal Non-Game Resources Division Administrator, and Sarah Zamorski, who is the Whooping Crane Project Biologist. Bob and Sarah, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, glad to be with you.
Bob, you were honored recently, about a month ago. You got the 2014 Governor's Award for Conservationist of the Year. And that involved your work in managing the resources and being the team leader on the reintroduction of the whooping crane. First of all, congratulations on that. You noted in your acceptance that the vision that leads to awareness leads to appreciation, which leads to protection. I think that says it all when you're talking about reintroducing this. Tell everybody, and I'm going to get into the details with Sarah, but why did the whooping cranes, what happened to that population originally? Why did they go away?
Well, it's a very vulnerable species. They do not have survival advantage. Parasites, let's say, we sent a black bear. Very white, not nocturnal, and so they're just so vulnerable to human harm. And misconceptions, that was during the period of exploitation of lots of wildlife across America, late 1800s, early 1900s. All the buffalo, the antelope, whooping cranes, many other species were extirpated and used in this country, not just Louisiana. And so they were shot, they were eaten. Egg collectors, habitat dramatically altered. So species that has a low fecundity, low reproductive rate, well, it cannot sustain. So that's what happened. We haven't had them in a long time. So it's been on the radar, and a lot of people have been encouraging us to get back in the game, and the other reintroductions around the country maybe have been failing. So millions have been spent, years, decades, dedicated service. It wasn't because of lack of hard work, but it was time for Louisiana to step up. We always knew we had the key element, shallow water on the prairie. If the prairie speaks, shallow water on the prairie is expensive. Nowhere but Louisiana off, and they wintered in the Western Gulf, have a lot of that.
Yeah.
For example, the eastern migratory population, there's 350 million people in America. Thirds of them live in the eastern one-third of the United States. Wherever man goes, they alter the habitat in a negative way. Wetlands are the most active type of habitat, all the degrading and everything. That's where they're trying to overlay a migratory population. Very, very difficult. So in Louisiana, firstly, there has been some modification by mankind. Plus, we've still got that all going on. Couple million acre prairie right adjacent to, not offered anywhere else.
Yeah, Sarah, tell us about the whooping crane. What does a whooping crane look like? How are you going to help them survive?
Well, whooping cranes are one of the cool things about them. They are the tallest North American bird. So a lot of people might be seeing great blue herons or maybe even santo cranes, egrets, things like that. And those birds 3 to 4 feet high, but a whooping crane can reach height of 5 feet. So, you know, they're as tall as some people, and they're going to be much larger than anything else people might be. So they're distinctive in how big they are. They are a solid white bird that has black wingtips, although the black wingtips are only visible if they're flying or if they stretch or flap their wings. So if they're standing on the ground, black wingtips aren't visible. And as adults, they've got a bare red patch of skin on the top of their head and black facial markings on the side of their face. They're sort of a real distinctive-looking bird, bright white. Like Bob said, they're not cryptic. They don't blend in with the surrounding vegetation or habitat. They're white, and they're real distinctive, large, stand out. So they're real neat because of those things. And you know, there's only we're certainly trying to do what we can to help them, but there's only so much we can do. I mean, some of it at some point, once we release the birds, they're out on their own, is up to them. And part of that is placing them in areas where the habitat will support them. Indiana certainly has a lot of available habitat that we think will be good for whooping cranes, and that cranes are find perhaps even more habitat than we thought they might have chosen. Initially, they're using a lot of agriculture, rice, crawfish, which is essentially a shallow wetland. So it's the same type of habitat they like. So it's in agriculture setting. Birds are finding that and liking that as well. And that. Of course, the other component that we're working hard on is public support, because ultimately it's about public support, not just here in Louisiana, but across the country. The public doesn't support this project and cranes help protect them, whether it's protecting and preserving their land or reporting or harming loop cranes, then ultimately they won't survive. They have to have public support behind this project for any other project. So a lot of our efforts, aside from the birds, are to just try and do a lot of education and outreach to the citizens to make aware of the project, try and get them. Not everybody has to love whooping cranes, be a big super fan of whooping cranes, but we just spoke to, you know, leave them alone and let them do their own thing.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research on the whooping crane population in Texas at that refuge. I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's in on the Gulf Coast, obviously. But this
Aransas.
That's it. Thank you very much. And these cranes fly all the way back to Canada, I guess Alberta, in the summer, and then fly all the way back, you know, to the Gulf Coast in the winter. I do not understand how a bird can be hardwired to do that. But will these cranes in Louisiana do that? Will they go back to Canada, or what do you think is going to happen in their migration?
So these birds and migration is an amazing and sort of fascinating and very unknown sort of serious topic, how birds, how various animals migrate and navigate like that. But historically, there were both populations of cranes that were migratory, but also populations that were non-migratory, which meant they lived in one place year-round. And for cranes, migration is mostly a learned behavior. So young juvenile cranes would learn that migration route by following their parents. And once they learn it one way, then they know how to repeat it on their own since then. So historically, Louisiana had a non-migratory population of whooping cranes, and also our birds have not been taught or shown a migration route. So our birds will be migratory, so they'll live in the migration is also about a cold northern climate. Obviously,
right.
Those birds that come down to the Gulf Coast of Texas, they would not know the Northwest Territories of Canada at, you know, in wintertime, you know, the water freezes, there's snow covers, you know, all their food sources. So the birds have to move south to be able to find food and fresh water. In Louisiana, that's not a problem at any time of year. There's not a need to find water.
That's great.
And they haven't caught. So our birds will be gone.
I never knew the story on that. That's great. Bob,
yep.
I have a kind of a not a legal question, but at least a policy question. I read in doing some research on getting ready for this, I read that you or the organization, the state, went to the Department of Interior and established an experimental population status where the species was treated as a not endangered but a threatened. What's the difference between that, and why is that an advantage for Louisiana?
Well, called the NJ rule to the Endangered Species Act, and in 1976, subsequent to the amendments to the Endangered Species Act, they allowed this NJ rule, allows for the non-essential experimental population. It's really, in simple form, a method that allows the general public to accept endangered species restoration, where the animals have to basically live in modern society, and the people don't have to stop with their normal lifestyle activities, those restoration projects, waterfowl hunting, oil and gas extraction, cattle farming, whatever. Go about your lifestyle. That bird has to adjust to you. Okay? So if, for example, a crawfish farmer wants to drain his water, plant rice, you know, that bird's going to end up without water, unfortunately. So if it's standing in his rough farm. and we'll adapt, we'll adjust to that. So it's a provision that the experimental part allows us to catch them and handle them, transmitters, some new things that are, you know, difficult to do to fully endangered status. So mm-hmm. it's the entire boundary of the state of Louisiana, most of the eastern United States, all of the, federal register, and it allows for us to experimentally reduce its population. What it means is if every one of our birds dies, it's not essential. It has no bearing on that wild population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference. And it's really been beneficial to many different species of restoration. And it allows our modern society, allows the public to accept the kind of thing. After all, what is wild in it? You know, in our modern society, where has man not impacted the earth, modern life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a unique way of handling it, and that's going to have a very positive feeling to independent-minded sportsmen and women who
there
are hunting.
There will never be any critical habitat designation in non-essential experimental population.
Mm-hmm. Well, Louisiana is the sportsman's paradise, Sarah and Bob, and I'd love to hear from either one of you. What can somebody in Georgia or North Carolina or Texas do to help you get the whooping crane back to Louisiana?
Public has to want it. And if people in out of state or elsewhere are interested in helping us, we have a foundation. It's critical because this is a very expensive project that was actually sold in based on value-added funding model. So certainly, have it in front of me. I'll find it.
Yeah, we'll post it.
Website,
we'll post. Yeah, we'll absolutely post
if
it.
If you could do that, that would be wonderful. Kel McInnes, our foundation director, has been very helpful and a partner helping to get this done. It just takes got a wonderful, dedicated team, and we're going to do our part. I believe my own personal religious philosophy is God created all these species innate abilities to build the earth in their number. As long as you provide them a good habitat, a little protection, they know what to do. They will get it done. I think they're going to do their part. We're going to do our part. So convince the rest of the Louisiana public, crawfish farmers, young people coming out of middle school and high school, they're outdoor riding around on country roads. We need them to do their part. Everybody is aware, believe, awareness, appreciation.
That's it. That's it, folks. If you you heard, now you know about the whooping crane. Sarah Zamorski and Bob Love from the State of Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we're behind this. We'll help promote it, and we'll check back in with you later on to see how it's going.
Thank you for your support, Art. We need your help.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
The Outpost Radio on Demand from the on-demand page of theoutpostlife.com.